So sorry for being late. My name is Chris Segoyan. I'm the principal technologist for the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. So I'm a computer scientist, and I work for a team of lawyers that do litigation in the area of national security and surveillance. So the general idea is to perform, to be effective advocates in 2013 on issues of surveillance, you need to actually have people who understand the surveillance working with the people doing the suing. And so I sit next to the lawyers and I make sure that what we're saying in our cases is accurate and actually reflects technology. I finished a PhD last year that was focused on the role that phone companies and internet companies play in facilitating surveillance of their customers. So this presentation is loosely based on some of my PhD research. Normally I give this thing on a stage, walking around with a fancy mic. Because the room is so small here, I'm more than happy for you all to interrupt with questions when you have them. There's no need that I need to be talking to you for an hour. So this is Justice Brandeis, who's one of the most famous Supreme Court justices in my area, in the area of privacy. So the first wiretaps were in about 1895 in New York, and it wasn't until 1928, so more than 30 years later, that the Supreme Court finally got around to addressing this issue, and unfortunately it went the wrong way the first time around. But Brandeis wrote a dissent in that case, so the dissent is where he's on the losing side, but he wants to still make his opinions known, and he said in this very, very famous dissent, "The power of science in furnishing the government with the means of espionage is not likely to stop with wiretapping." He added, "Ways may someday be developed by which the government, without removing papers from secret drawers, can reproduce them in court, and by which it will be enabled to expose to a jury the most intimate occurrences of the home." This is in 1928, before the internet, before Facebook, before Google. When Brandeis was really what he was worried about back then were things like cameras, this new technology that had come on the scene that allowed people to be photographed without their consent. But he saw that things were going to get bad down the line. He didn't quite understand how the technology was going to work, but he knew that at some point the government would be able to learn who you were writing to, how you were communicating, what you were thinking, the contents of your papers, without ever physically entering your home. And he was right. He was 100% right. He just didn't know that it would happen through Google. So this is what wiretapping looks like in the movies. This is a slightly old image, but depending on which movie you see, the general theme is the same, right? You have a couple FBI agents in an unmarked van outside someone's house. Maybe it'll say Joe's Pizza Delivery Shop on the side of the van. And the image we see, whether it's in a movie or a cop show, you know, The Wire, is the agents hunched over a pair of headphones listening to the calls that are taking place inside. And that's actually not what wiretapping looks like anymore, and in fact hasn't looked like that for more than a decade or two. Modern wiretapping, modern surveillance looks like this. It's just someone typing at a keyboard, causing the conversations to be automatically recorded and sent back to the police officers or the FBI agent's office. So we know, I'm telling you, that wiretapping involves just typing on a keyboard. So the question is, you know, whose fingers are behind the keyboard? Do the police have direct access into Verizon's telephone system? Does the FBI have the direct ability to get straight into Google systems and obtain your emails? Well, no, for the most part. The employees of all of these companies that we entrust our private data to, they're the ones who are acquiring our communications and giving it to the government. They're forced to by law, and so every big internet and telephone company has a team of agents who do nothing but respond to requests from the police. They work 24/7. I mean, not they work in shifts 24/7. There are 800 numbers that can be reached. You know, night or day, there's someone at Google or Verizon or Facebook who is responding to requests. The government demands this of these companies. And this is sort of the unadvertised feature of being an internet company. When you are a company that handles user data, when you have your customers' communications, at some point the government is going to come and ask for them. And you know, we can have a debate about when the government should be able to get them, if they should have to get a warrant from a judge, da 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 da. But at some point, the government is going to come, and so all of these companies have had to staff up teams of people who do nothing but respond to requests. And these are separate from the teams who do nothing but respond to requests from divorce lawyers. That's an entirely separate part of the business. So the most we've known for several years. Oh, and I should also note that for the most part, everything you're going to hear today is not about the NSA. And so I spent 6 years studying this stuff. It's impossible to find out what the NSA is doing unless you get someone like Edward Snowden who leaks documents. No one will talk to you. It's all classified. And so I wanted to figure out sort of what the scale of surveillance was, how it was working, and if I tried to research NSA surveillance, I would have finished in 6 years with one page of information. So I had to write something, and so I focused on the cops. The most about what we know for the last few years has come from voluntary disclosures by companies. So big internet companies like Google produce reports twice a year revealing how many requests they get from the cops. And they don't say that Joe Schmo got the FBI wanted Joe Schmo's email, but they say, you know, last year we received 6,000 requests in the first 6 months. And so Google started doing this, I think, in about mid-2011. The numbers here have gone up, I think, to maybe 8,000 or 9,000 requests every 6 months. So Google, yes, sir?
In general, does a request, is that one person, or can they say, here's, you know, five people we want in one request, or do they say?
So that's a really good question. You'll see from, I know you're in the cheap seats in the back, but you'll see on the screen there's two numbers. One are the user requests, and then the second one is the user accounts. So what this means here is that at least some of the requests that Google's getting are for multiple accounts per request. There may not be a one-to-one relationship there, so there may be, you know, one request for 100 accounts and another, and then several other ones for one account. There was a question somewhere. Hang on, wait for the mic, sir.
I'm sorry. Are all of these data requests tied to a search warrant?
So that's also a good question. U.S. surveillance law. I'll get into it in a little bit down the deck, but the law that we have dates to 1986. That was the last time Congress amended our electronic privacy laws. And the law as written then doesn't really mesh with how technology is used today. The standard that we have loosely, the government needs a warrant signed by a judge, and they need to be able to convince the judge that they have probable cause that the information sought is evidence of a crime. That's for email. But information about what you do on the internet, about where you're going, the websites you might be viewing, the computer address you're coming from, the telephone numbers that you call, that's all information that they can get with less than a warrant. Either a lesser order from a judge, or in many cases they can just use this thing called a subpoena, which is, it's basically a letter from the FBI. The FBI agents have a blank stack of subpoenas on their desk, the same way that a doctor would have prescriptions. Right? I mean, I'm not criticizing the subpoena process, that's just how it works. That subpoenas aren't supposed to be signed by judges for the most part. So, you know, we don't know from the numbers that Google has released what percentage are for the contents of emails and which ones are records of how many people search for the following terms and which ones are for, you know, everyone who watched this jihadi video. Like, we don't know. They haven't broken it down in that detail. Google also breaks their numbers down by country. So we know that the Brazilians also really like to make lots of surveillance requests, and the Germans do too. And we know that Google largely tells the Russians to take a hike when the Russian government goes to Google. You know, one general rule of thumb is that if a company has an office in a country, then they have to respond to requests from that country. If you have engineers or any employees there, if you refuse to hand over data, your employees get arrested. And so, you know, Google, for example, would likely refuse every request from the Iranian government. Not because they, you know, have a bone to pick, but they don't have an office there, so there's nothing that the government can do to them. All right, so Google was probably the first big company, I think, to provide these stats. Twitter has followed through. Twitter obviously gets far fewer requests, not because they are a smaller company, but most of what Twitter has isn't sensitive. You know, your tweets, for the most part, are going to be public information, so the government is rarely going to be going to Twitter for that. They usually will try and find out where you're logging in from if you have an anonymous Twitter account. And Facebook, so these slides are a little bit old. Facebook just released stats for the first time last week. So the Snowden stuff has been very, very good in terms of gently or not so gently pushing companies to be a bit more transparent. And so the general theme here has been that the Snowden revelations have implied that the companies are sharing data on a wholesale basis, and the companies say, no, we're not giving all of our customers' information to the government. We're only giving some of our customers' information to the government. And so Facebook released their report last week showing, I think, that the U.S. government is making about 12,000 requests every 6 months. Facebook receives more requests from U.S. law enforcement agencies than Google or Twitter or Microsoft, which I think is interesting. Facebook also receives a vast number of requests from divorce lawyers, but that's also a separate thing. So the numbers that the numbers of requests that the internet companies receive, the surveillance requests that they receive, are in the, say, tens of thousands a year. And these are really sort of small change in the grand scheme of things. We have, 300 million people in this country. The big recipients of surveillance requests are the phone companies. The phone companies have been getting wiretap requests for more than 100 years. They have a comfortable relationship with the government when it comes to surveillance. They know how the game works. And the phone companies have been the least transparent. We didn't really find out any data about the scale of requests that the phone companies receive until 2012, till last summer, when Ed Markey, a congressman and now senator from Massachusetts, sent letters to the phone companies to say, hey, how many requests do you guys get a year? I just want to know a high-level number. And the response that he got, I think, blew the mind of everyone who read it, including folks like me who've been following this for years. The number was 1.5 million requests a year. So the number of requests that Google gets is like a rounding error compared to the requests that the phone companies are getting. And, the phone companies have this rich source of data that, in fact, many other companies don't have. In particular, they have information about location. They know where you are at all times, or at least they can find that out if the government asks them to. So the Markey letters that we got last summer were really the first time that we're able to learn the true scale of these surveillance requests. So in 2009, I'll just back up a second. In 2009, I went to a surveillance conference. It's a little bit like this, with where the main costume are just ugly suits. And I went to this conference in Washington, D.C., and it's nicknamed the Wiretapper's Ball. The name of the conference is Telestrategies, Intelligence and Surveillance World, I think. And so the conference is an annual meeting of telephone company employees, internet companies, the companies that manufacture surveillance technology, so that's surveillance software and hardware, and then law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And the conference is in Washington, D.C., and I attended. And Washington, D.C. is what's called a one-party consent city, which means that as long as one person in the room knows that something's being recorded, then it's kosher. And so I was that one person. And I brought a microphone and recorder into one of the panels that I attended. And the panel was like a show and tell, basically. The phone company employees would sit on stage and talk about their experiences responding to surveillance requests. I didn't know what they were going to say, but I recorded one of the panels anyway. And so I'm going to read you a brief quote from Paul Taylor, who's the head of surveillance for Sprint. Quote, "We turned on our GPS web interface for law enforcement about 1 year ago, and we just passed 8 million requests. There's just no way on earth my team could have handled 8 million requests from law enforcement just for GPS alone." So what had happened, this isn't 8 million users, this is 8 million interactions with this website. And what had happened was that Sprint was getting so many requests for location data from the police that they couldn't handle them by themselves. The Sprint employees just didn't have the resources, and I think Sprint has 200 people who do nothing but respond to surveillance requests. They just couldn't keep up with the requests. And so they did what any sort of tech company might do. They automated the problem. They built a self-service website where the police could log in. And get the data for themselves. So they would be authorized on a case-by-case basis to get it, and then for that point on, for the next 30 days or what have you, the police could just log in to a Google Maps type interface and see a little blue dot where their current target was. And this was used to generate 8 million unique GPS data points in 1 year. One second, sir. So Paul Taylor added, this tool has just really caught on fire with law enforcement. They love that it is extremely inexpensive to operate and easy to use. Yes, sir.
The 1.5 million requests from the government, is that for the combined telephone companies or just one telephone company?
So that's all four of the big wireless carriers, Sprint, Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile.
Okay, thank you.
What was most fascinating about those numbers to me was that of the 1.5 million requests, 500,000 of those were just subpoenas to Sprint. So this Sprint is the third largest phone company, and a subpoena doesn't involve a judge. And so with a subpoena, you can get like who the customer's name is, where they live, and then all the numbers they've dialed in the past. And I was thinking, why the hell is this third largest phone company, not the first one, but why is this third largest phone company getting, with just subpoenas alone, one third of all the requests received by all of the companies? You know, and that doesn't include requests for location data or wiretaps or web browsing information. This is just basically numbers dialed. And I scratched my head and I kept thinking, and then the next time I went into 7-Eleven, I realized Sprint has basically dominated the prepaid market for cell phones. If you buy a Boost or Virgin phone at 7-Eleven, they're using Sprint's network. In fact, they got bought by Sprint because they were so successful. Sprint owns the prepaid market, particularly the brand targeting urban communities. And so insofar as prepaid phones are popular, are frequently used by people who the government might be engaging in surveillance on, Sprint receives a lot of requests. There's a question from the gentleman in the periodic table T-shirt. Sorry to out you.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. As a clarification, I'm asking, you had said that it generated 8 million data points. That is another data point, the time when a person goes from the road to the WIC, to the pizza place and so forth, or is
if they had configured their system to track, to get to ping your phone every 5 minutes, then each of those pings would be a data point. So if they were checking your location every 5 minutes, 24 hours a day, then you know that could just, that 8 million number could be 10,000 targets, or it could be one target if you were pinging them, you know, every second. Yes, sir.
I'm not a criminal, but I know that people do. I interact with former criminals, people getting out of jail on my job. A lot of people do get burner cell phones just for the purpose of staying off the grid, so to speak. The reason being, you pick up a burner cell phone, you can move somewhere else, dump it, get another burner cell phone, move somewhere else, dump it, get another. You're saying all of this basically defeats the purpose if you can track down the source of the burner cell phone purchase.
Yeah,
that'd be correct.
So burner phones are not as anonymous as people think they might be. So even if you walk into 7-Eleven and you buy a phone with cash and you're wearing a mask, when to the video at 7-Eleven doesn't even catch you, you're the only person that sleeps at your house and goes to your office. And you're the only person that calls your husband or wife or girlfriend and calls your mom on weekends. And so it doesn't matter whose number the phone is registered in, or whose name the phone is registered in, or whether it's registered at all. Your phone is the only phone that's in your house at night and at your office in the day. And when they look at the location records, that phone sticks out like a sore thumb. And you can buy a new phone every week, but they'll know that it was the same person and who's just obtained a new number. It's a question in the back. That's your right.
Does this change at all if we're talking about like programs on iPhone or Android that replicate burners?
So there are some, those of you who don't know in the room, there are services that will let you obtain disposable cell phone numbers, and they route the voice calls over the internet instead of over the phone company's network. One could build such a service to be more secure and more anonymous. It is my understanding that the companies that offer those services are retaining an extensive amount of data about where the calls are coming from and who's registering them. And My understanding is the market they're aiming at, they may call the, like there's one of the services is called Burner. They may be framing themselves in marketing materials as like the anonymous phone service. That's not for buying drugs. That, and I'm not encouraging any of you to buy drugs in general. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm definitely not your lawyer. I think they're more for like blind date kind of situations where you want to be able to never hear from that creepy person ever again, as opposed to something that can actually withstand the power of a subpoena or the power of a search warrant. All right, so let me just get through a few more slides, and then I'll let folks ask some more questions. As I said, you know, the cops, according to Sprint, love this tool because it's easy to use and cheap. So this is an excerpt from a surveillance manual. So every telephone and internet company has a document that they put together for cops, letting them know the procedures of the surveillance team at the phone company. It's sort of like a menu. You walk into a restaurant and the price for the salad is less than the soup, or the price for the steak is more than the pasta. Well, the phone companies and internet companies have menus for surveillance. A wiretap costs more than records of who you've called. Live interception of, you know, the microphone and your camera is going to cost more than your emails. And then they have copies of subpoenas or warrants saying this is the kind of language we want. You know, when you go to a judge, make sure to ask for this. We're going to need this. And fax it to here. And here's where you pay us and that kind of stuff. And companies get paid. They're allowed to charge reasonable fees. So whatever it costs them to employ 200 people, you know, all year round to respond to requests, they can divide those costs by the number of requests they receive and charge the government, you know, $50 a go. So this is an excerpt from Sprint Nextel's surveillance manual from 2003. And what I want you to understand is that as recently as 10 years ago, they charged $150 per time every time the police wanted to track your location. So what would happen is the police would call up Sprint. They'd say, we're interested in this target. We've got this order from a judge. Where is he now? And a Sprint person would type into a keyboard. They'd get the location, and then they'd give that to the police. That was $150. Every time they called up, it was $150. This invoice is from 2009. I suspect you can't see it in the back very well, but the short version is, so this is an invoice that we got through a Freedom of Information Act request from the police in Raleigh, North Carolina. Sprint now charges $30 a month for all-you-can-eat location data if you're the cops. there's a few sort of observations about this. The first is that, you know, I don't know about you, but nothing on my phone bill has gone down in price over the last 10 years. And it seems a little bit strange that on matters of surveillance where there's no competition, it's not like Verizon can undercut Sprint in spying on my phone if I'm a Sprint customer. So the first thing is the price has gone down. The second thing is that, you know, I suspect that everyone in this room has been to an all-you-can-eat buffet at some point. And when you pay a flat fee for a resource, you tend to go back for that second plate. And now that Sprint is providing the police unlimited location data for $30 a month per target, there is likely, you know, no financial disincentive stopping the police from getting that one more data point. All right, so in general, two things protect us from living in a surveillance state. The first one is the law. And as I hinted at before, the law that protects us from government surveillance, the law that regulates how the government monitors us, is called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This law was written in 1986, before Google, before Facebook, before Twitter. If you had a phone or email in 1986, you know, your phone looked like this, and you were probably using CompuServe, or I don't even know if AOL was around then, or Genie, I think, was one of the other services. And if you had an email account, you probably had a 2 megabyte inbox, right? That's how big they were back then. And the way you conduct email when you have a 2 megabyte inbox, and I know there are probably people in this room who had accounts back then, was when, you know, someone sends you an email, you read it and you delete it because you need to free up the space for the next email. And so the law that was written by Congress in 1986 was written in such a way that emails that have been kept around more than half a year are considered abandoned. Because in 1986, who would ever keep emails around for more than half a year? You would delete them and make space for the new emails. And you know, back then, if someone sent you a half megabyte email, you'd freak out because they'd fill up your inbox. So that's how the law was written. And so what we end up with is this crazy system of laws where if the government wants to get your emails and they're more than half a year old, they don't need a search warrant anymore. If you've opened the emails at least once, they don't need a search warrant anymore. If the emails have been saved in the sent mail folder after you've sent them, they don't need a search warrant anymore. The only emails that are protected with a warrant standard per the law written by Congress are emails that have never been opened, that are less than 180 days old, that are sitting in your inbox. And anything in your draft folder or your sent mail folder or emails that you've clicked on once are fair game for the government to get with less than a warrant.
Question?
Yes.
Is that statutory or regulatory?
So that's statutory. That's the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Luckily, the courts have stepped in and boosted the privacy for email. So the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals had an opinion in a case a couple years ago, ultimately ruling that all emails are protected by the Fourth Amendment. So the statute is like a floor, and the courts raised it. And so regardless of whether the emails are opened or have never been opened or are 180 days old or 200 days old, we get full warrant protection for emails because of this appellate opinion. Interestingly enough, or maybe not interesting, depending on whether you're a geek like me, the opinion, the case that decided that emails deserved warrant protections under the Fourth Amendment was a case involving a guy who was selling herbal Viagra online. So those spam emails you receive offering to make your genitalia larger, they have done something for us, even if you haven't bought them. All right, so as I said, two things protect us from a surveillance state. The first is the law, and the law is old and busted. And the second is the expense or difficulty of surveillance. So I like to think of surveillance in terms of friction. When surveillance is really expensive, the police do less of it, and when it's more cheap, the police can do more of it. You have to understand that the police and the FBI, like every government agency, they have fixed resources. They have a lot of resources, but they do have fixed resources, which means there are probably more people they'd like to spy on than the resources they have, and so they have to figure out who's important, and they have to prioritize with the resources they have. And when surveillance becomes cheaper, they can go further down their wish list and spy on people. So this is a quote from a very prominent judge in the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. Technological progress poses a threat to privacy by enabling an extent of surveillance that in earlier times would have been prohibitively expensive. And so really what he's talking about in this case is the fact that cheap surveillance is a threat to our privacy. I mean, there's a skit that Chris Rock has where he talks about his views on guns, and I'm not going to get into the Second Amendment here, but Chris Rock believes that guns should be legal, but bullets should be $1 million a piece. And I sort of share that same philosophy on surveillance. I understand the government's going to do it, but I would prefer that it were much more expensive. So I spent several years trying to figure out how much... Yes, sir?
Is there a difference when making a location request for a GPS-enabled phone versus a triangulation from cellular information? And is that more difficult, less expensive, any of those?
Okay, so I think cell phone tracking is a really exciting topic. Most people don't agree with me. So Congress told the phone companies that they needed to be able to provide real-time, accurate location data. But they didn't tell the phone companies how they had to do it. It was left up to the phone companies. And what ended up happening was that Verizon and Sprint decided to go with GPS. So they put a GPS chip in every phone they sell, whether it is a $300 smartphone or a $10 burner. You may not be able to use the GPS chip yourself, but it's there. And it can be remotely activated without your knowledge or consent. And so the Verizon and Sprint went down the GPS path. T-Mobile and AT&T decided to put an expensive device on every cell tower that does something called triangulation. And basically, three towers share information about where they think you are, and that lets them accurately locate you on a plane. Neither one happens with you knowing it. You're not, you know, you may open up Google Maps on your phone and see a little flashing satellite icon in the top. You don't see that when the government's locating your phone. There's no indication. The GPS setting on your phone that disables apps access to your GPS chip, that doesn't stop the government either. That's for your benefit, you know, when it comes to Angry Birds tracking you. That doesn't help you when it comes to the government. So all of the companies are able to locate their customers. The GPS chip has some downsides. The GPS chip approach has some downsides. You know, if you've ever tried to use Google Maps in an urban area, sometimes with really tall buildings, it's tough to get a fix on the satellite. You need to be able to see the sky. GPS definitely doesn't work when you're in a building or in a basement. And the triangulation approach works really well everywhere. I think the police would much prefer that triangulation were being used everywhere, but only two of the four big companies support that. And so all of the companies have the capability to locate their customers with a fairly high degree of precision, say less than 5 meters in many cases, but the technology they use differs. All right, so I spent several years trying to figure out how much the companies were charging. I think that charging is interesting. I think the invoices are great because they create a bit of transparency. Like when you charge for surveillance, there's a paper trail. Someone has to approve the check. There's paper sent back and forth, and that means that as a researcher and activist, I can try and get these documents. And so I got a copy of an invoice that Google sent to the U.S. Marshals a few years ago. The only thing that's really important here is that little thing there. So Google charges $25 for the contents of your inbox to the police. That's what they believe their reasonable fee is. And I'm not going to, you know, argue with them. It doesn't cost that much money to receive a request and type a few commands in a keyboard and send off a DVD in the mail. It's not particularly labor intensive. But so Google's price is $25. These are invoices or excerpts from invoices that Yahoo sent. And I got about 100 invoices from Yahoo over a 3-year period. So you can see here it's $20.39, and then in the bottom, $20.41. And so I got this huge stack of invoices from Yahoo. And the Google one made sense, right? Like $25 is a nice round number. But I didn't understand the 39 cents and the 41 cents. Like I just didn't know what these pennies were for. And these weren't the only numbers in the penny column. I had a whole range, and so I did. I with a colleague of mine, you know, we sat on the floor of my office, and we organized the invoices by the last two digits to see, like, you know, were they falling into groups? And we saw that there was a relationship between the date of the request. The older requests had a lesser number of pennies. The newer requests had a higher number of pennies. And it took us 2 days to realize what was going on. The 39 cents and 41 cents, that's the cost of a stamp. And so every time the post office raises the cost of a stamp by 2 cents, Yahoo passes on the same number of pennies to the feds, which I think means they're nickel and diming them, which I think is a good thing. I think you should always nickel and dime the government. At a high level, there are companies that want to protect their customers' data from the government, or at least want to make it a little bit more difficult. There are things that companies can do, but at the end of the day, companies have to hand over your data to the government. When the police come with the right kind of request, if they come with a warrant for your emails, Google has to hand them over. There's nothing they can do at that point. If they have the emails and the police come with a warrant, the police are getting your emails. But there is flexibility in other areas. There's other ways that companies that like privacy can do a bit of work to protect that privacy. So as I mentioned before, Google has provided these reports to the public. They're not required by any law to produce a report twice a year. They're just choosing to do that because they think that an informed populace will lead to a debate about privacy. They're actually being a good corporate citizen in doing that. So another form of transparency relates to actually telling the target of the surveillance order. So when the government comes to Google with a request for your email, the government doesn't have to tell you. You may never, in fact, learn that you were the target unless they arrest you and charge you, and then your defense counsel learn about it. We actually have this really, there's no children here. We have a really fucked up system where if you are the target of surveillance and you're arrested, you may learn about it later. But if you are innocent of any crime and you're never charged, you'll never learn the police were reading your emails or obtaining your location data. I think that's really messed up. I think, you know, the system should be optimized for the innocent. If you are innocent of any crime and the police obtain your emails, you should be told at some point down the road. But we don't have that. And so the police or the FBI are not required by law to tell you. But the companies can. They're not required to, but they are free to in many cases. And so this wiggle room exists in the law where the companies could, if they wish to, tell you, but are not required to tell you. And so some companies have established policies of always notifying users about requests for their data unless they get a gag order from a judge. And so Google and Twitter are sort of two of the leading companies in this space of establishing this policy of we will always tell our users unless we're not allowed to. And so this came really to the front page a couple years ago. Twitter received some court orders for information about users who were associated with WikiLeaks, one of whom is a US-based programmer named Jake Applebaum. And Twitter not only had this policy of always telling their users, but in this case, the request that they'd received included a gag order. So they were actually prohibited from telling those users, and Twitter went even further than their policy required and asked the government to remove the gag. The government removed the gag, they told the users, then it was front page news. Later that year, we learned that Google had received a similar request, but that Google had been unsuccessful in convincing the government to remove the gag. There have been probably a dozen instances that I know of in the last year or two where Twitter has told users that have led to media reports. Twitter routinely tells their customers. So this is a nice thing. It means that if you are the target of the surveillance, you can hire a lawyer who can try and challenge the order. And you may be successful, you may be unsuccessful, but at least you know what's going on. Universally, you will never find out from the phone companies. There's never going to be a situation where Verizon sends you a letter in the mail and says, oh, by the way, last month we got a request for your phone records and we handed it over to the government. It's never going to happen. And the reason is, it's not good for business. The phone companies don't want to worry their users. You know, they're going to have to hand data over, so why upset people? And so as, yes, sir, in the back.
Have you looked into what the government is required to do with this data that they collect? In other words, is it protected once they get it, or is it available to anybody who wants to look at it in the government and it may want to sell it to somebody else?
So I don't think that the police are allowed to sell, or I doubt the police are selling your data. In fact, I think they're probably prohibited from doing it. What I do know is that once they obtain your emails in an investigation or your phone records, they can hang on to those and use those for other investigations. And so the DEA, for example, has this gigantic database with, I think, more than a billion entries. We learned about it a couple weeks ago in a Reuters story. So basically, every time the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, obtains records of who someone's called, they just put them in a big database. And they just keep adding to it because at some point one of those numbers might show up in another case, and they want to, you know, they don't want to start from scratch again. So they can certainly keep the data that they've already obtained and use it for other unrelated investigations. The phone companies are not allowed to sell this information to private investigators or divorce lawyers or advertising companies.
Okay, I'm just asking you if it's secure. The government keeps it secure. Whether
against what? I mean, the FBI has been hacked. Local law enforcement agencies have been hacked. You know, local police agencies generally don't have the best resources when it comes to IT. You know, has someone left a wiretap document, you know, on their desk and for the cleaning people to see at night? Probably. Has every police agency securely disposed of data and not just left it in the dumpster? I doubt that. In the same way that, you know, there are companies who routinely dispose of user data in a poor way. You know, there are medical companies that, you know, put sensitive files in dumpsters without shredding them. I wouldn't be shocked to hear that kind of thing. So as I said, Google and Twitter are transparency leaders in this regard. They have established policies of telling users about requests when they can. But even though they're transparency leaders, the government still gets the data. Right? Even though Twitter tells you, by the way, the feds asked for your information, they still have to give it to the government. And so telling users only goes so far when it comes to keeping the data out of the government's hands. The most effective way to keep users' data out of the government's hands is to not keep the data in the first place. Right? This seems intuitive, but in fact is not a routinely followed practice in Silicon Valley. And the general problem is, many of these big tech companies have established public policies revealing how long they hang onto your data. So Google, for example, keeps records of what you search for at least 18 months. In fact, they keep it for longer, but they take steps to anonymize portions of it. Yes, sir. Hang on a second. Wait for the mic.
I was going to say I've actually looked at my Google search history, and it goes back to like 2007.
So that's if you... So there's a separate thing called Google search history, which is a feature that initially was opt-in and I think later became opt-out. So even if you turn search history off, or even if you're never logged in, they keep records for 18 months. If you have this feature called search history turned on, then they will retain search records indefinitely and associate those to your account. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So Google retains things for at least 18 months. Bing, which is the search engine that no one uses, keeps things for 6 months. Twitter keeps records for about 18 months, although in practice I think it's less. And Facebook has no public policy for how long they retain data. We've been pushing them for a while, and they've not yet established any kind of policy and shared it with the world. The phone companies also have policies for how long they retain data, although figuring this out was not easy. This information that I'm showing you here, and I'll read it out to you so that you can learn about it in the back of the room. This came from a Freedom of Information Act request that we made, that the ACLU made to a local law enforcement agency. That's how we found out that the phone companies don't put it on their website. But so this is the data retention for what are called call detail records. That's the numbers of who you call and when you call them, who you text when you text them. So the kind of information that might show up on a phone bill, or at least online, because they don't want to send you 50 pages every month. So the high level here is that Verizon is keeping data for a year, Sprint for about a year and a half, T-Mobile between 2 and 5 years, depending on whether you're prepaid or postpaid, and AT&T is the privacy loser in keeping stuff for about 7 years. They're not required by law to keep this kind of stuff. These companies are sort of like digital pack rats, so they're hanging onto it as long as they can because they think it might be useful later. One second, sir. This is a similar set of stats for location data. So the companies have records of every cell tower that you were near when you made a call. They don't have records of where you were when you weren't doing anything, but if you made or received a call or made or sent or received a text message, they know which cell tower you were using when you made that call, and that approximately locates you to, you know, a mile or two around that tower. Verizon is a year. Sprint is 18 months, T-Mobile is about 4 to 6 months, and again, AT&T is the loser with at least 3-year retention for cell phone location records. Yes, sir.
Hi, are they categorizing browsing history on your cell phone under data or call history?
The browsing history on your phones is considered a separate kind of data source. The phone companies do, in fact, retain records of the URLs that you browse from your phone. There's a criminal case that we've been involved with at work where the government requested, with not a search warrant, 1.8 million requests from 1.8 million URLs of a person's browsing history from Verizon, one person. Now, maybe, I don't know how active he was, I don't know if that was a week's data or 6 months, but they keep a lot of data about what you do on your phones. Every URL, until recently, that also meant every search term. This is a lot of really sensitive data, and the phone companies are just hanging on to it. They're not very transparent on this front. All right, and so... I mean, as much as I hate the phone companies, you at least pay them money. So if they wish to, they could keep less data. Like, the phone companies have a way of making money without storing all your data. They could destroy it, and then there'd be nothing to give to the police. But the dominant business model in Silicon Valley is we get these great services for free in exchange for giving them our data, right? And so the business model, the design is that user data goes in, they mine the data, they try and figure out what we're interested in, right? So Google wants to know whether you're male or female, what approximate age range you have, whether you're interested in buying a car in the next 6 months, whether you like sports, da-da-da-da. All of these companies put their users into these categories, and then they allow advertisers to target you with ads that they think are relevant and more likely to lead to you clicking on the ad and then buying something. And so the way they do that is by collecting vast amounts of data. There's no way for them to put you into these accurate buckets without years worth of emails, without years worth of web browsing activity. And the problem is that the business model in Silicon Valley is built around this. There's no way for these companies to not keep your data and to keep it out of the government's hands and also to be able to deliver ads that are accurate to you or ads that are more accurate. And so what this means then is that these business models are fundamentally incompatible with keeping your data private from the government. You know, I would like to be able to pay Google money, but there's no way to pay for search. There's no way to pay for Twitter. There's no way to pay for Facebook. All of these services are offered under one model, and that is the free model. You know, we pay for our phones, we pay for our cable TV connections, we pay for internet, we pay for stamps, but so many of the services that we use online are free, and there's no way to pay for them. This isn't a case of people being cheap, it's just there's no way to pay, and I think many people would pay, you know, $10 a year for email, or $50 a year for online backup. We're not talking massive sums of money here, but those options aren't available, and so all of these companies have gone down this path of building services that are free and data supported and ad supported. And the end result is that the companies are faced with this choice, right? Do we destroy the data as soon as we get it and then make it difficult for the government? Or do we hang on to the data as long as possible and then be able to return a profit to our shareholders? And you know, they do what anything most companies would do is they optimize for business. You know, the Silicon Valley employees are not cheap. And that those, you know, the salaries are $100,000 a year for a programmer out in California. They got to pay them somehow, and so the way they pay them is with your data. You know, I'll just mention, I have a couple minutes more. I'll just mention about the NSA stuff briefly. That, you know, when the Snowden revelations were first made public, it really blew the minds of many people in MySpace. You know, we knew that the government could obtain stuff, but knowing that they could and knowing that they were are two different things. And I think, you know, there have been so many reports and so many exposés and so many details about the NSA in the last couple of months that if you're not a nerd, a surveillance nerd, reading every single story, they can all sort of blur together. And so I just want to make sure that you all focus on the part that matters the most from my perspective, which is that the NSA is collecting data about every single American's phone calls and communications. We're not talking about suspected terrorists here. The view at the NSA is to find the needle in the haystack. You need the whole haystack. And so what they've done is they've gone to a court and convinced the court to reinterpret a key provision of the Patriot Act to allow the collection of every American's telephone call records. That's not what you say on the phone, but that's who you call, when you call them, whether they call you back, you know, all of your calling patterns. And that data reveals a really sensitive story. They have, in a government building somewhere now, a database of everyone who's called an abortion clinic in the last 5 years, everyone who's called a battered women's shelter, everyone who's called a suicide hotline, everyone who's called a whistleblower hotline to report waste or fraud. All of that information is sitting in a data center. And regardless of whether you think that whether you think that they're going to use it or not, just know that that data is sitting there. And think about how confident you are with the other parts of the government that you interact with on a regular basis. Think about how much you trust them to keep your data safe and secure. You know, they said that there was a system in place making sure that people couldn't inappropriately look at stuff and couldn't take stuff, but then Snowden managed to get all of these documents. Clearly, their audit system is not 100% foolproof. So just think about what I want you to sort of take with you when you leave today is the knowledge that all of your telephone records are sitting in an NSA data center, and it's not. And you don't have to be the target of an investigation for them to search through those records. That's all there. I'm not trying to scare you, but this is what's happening, and it's very easy to get lost in the noise around this issue. That's the part you have to focus on. Yes, sir, in the back.
What scares me more than the fact that they know that people have called a battered women's clinic is the fact that considering Hoover tried to blackmail Martin Luther King with with evidence that King had an affair, the NSA has all this information on Congress. And so if there's a congressman that ever is against them, and they can leak that this guy has a mistress, and that's there, and you will never know who leaked that. I mean, they now, if they so desire, they can control politics.
I'm sure there are no members of Congress who are engaging in affairs right now. None at all. None. Right. So for those of you who don't know, what the story that the gentleman told us is completely true. The FBI had secretly wiretapped Martin Luther King, found out that he was cheating on his wife, and then sent him an anonymous letter saying that he should kill himself. And attached to the letter was a recording of some of the conversations or activities with his girlfriend. So it was not one of the finer moments in the history of the FBI. I don't know. There's a lot of hands here, so let's start in the back over there with the gentleman in the red, and then we'll go around.
As a member of the ACLU, how are you ensuring the continuation of this research when you invariably get arrested and or put in jail?
So first off, if there are any ACLU members in the audience, thank you very much. I appreciate you paying some portion of my salary. I am surrounded by a team of spectacular lawyers. I am not that worried about what I do. I'm very confident that I will be okay, although my girlfriend isn't as confident about that. Let me say that the ACLU hiring a technologist was a big deal. About 4 or 5 years ago, they hired a scientist to work in-house with our team. She was, a geneticist. And out of her year and a half or 2 years at the ACLU came a case that was argued at the Supreme Court last year called the BRCA case, about whether markers for breast cancer and ovarian cancer could be patented. And the ACLU's position was that these genetic markers should not be patented, that there shouldn't be $10,000 tests for breast cancer. And we won that case at the Supreme Court this year. And that case came from taking a subject matter expert in science and putting them in the same room as a bunch of lawyers. And I think that's a really, really cool model of the way of doing business. My position is basically the same as the one that she had, except that I focus entirely on surveillance. We are hiring another technology fellow probably in the next month, a 2-year position. We're hiring, you know, a computer scientist or some kind of techie to do the same kind of work that I do. You know, the lawyers that I work with, they like working with people like me because I make their life a lot easier. Some ways I make their life more difficult, but it's much easier to understand surveillance when you have someone who knows about technology sitting next to you. And so they're never going to not have another technologist working there. This is the new way of doing business at the ACLU, and other civil liberties organizations are doing the same thing now. You cannot fight the government effectively when you don't know what's going on. And so part of that is included is hiring subject matter experts. There's a lot of hands. The gentleman in the far back of the room with the long hair, I realize that's a few people. Black t-shirt and long hair.
I just wanted to mention, when you were talking about the protections we have, the first one you had said was that the courts limit what the public scrutiny through the courts limits what the government can get. And then my concern when all the Snowden revelations came out was that this was done through a completely secret court with no records kept with the court, nothing that ever came to the public, so we had no protections whatsoever in that venue.
So in the intelligence context, when it comes to NSA surveillance, there is a different court that is deciding these things. They're called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC. They are not the most transparent of courts. They meet behind a locked door with a fingerprint reader in the third floor of the federal courthouse in D.C. They don't publish opinions. We got one published opinion last week as a result of a multi-year lawsuit by some of my friends at another organization. That system's really messed up. I'm not, you know, when the president tells you don't worry, there's oversight, you know. I don't think he's being entirely honest with us when he says that. All right, who else? The gentleman there, and we'll work our way around. Hang on, wait for the mic.
There's been a lot of talk about the metadata that's been stored, but my concern is that if they're storing metadata, they can actually store the data itself. And is there validation to the concern that they are actually not only storing the metadata on phone calls, but storing the phone calls themselves?
Okay, so for those of you who don't speak geek, metadata is the records about the call. So metadata is the who and the when and the, you know, the calling pattern information. And so the question is, you know, are they storing the contents of the calls too? We don't know. You know, the storage part is in fact the less interesting part. They don't have a way of easily listening to all the calls. I mean, there are systems that will do voice recognition, but as any of you who've called up an airline system and tried to, you know, say operator, 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 sometimes systems are not so good at recognizing voice. Metadata analysis, the analysis of the call records, is easy to do at scale. You can analyze terabytes of records easily with few errors, whereas when you're analyzing the contents of the calls, you have far more errors. So what they are likely doing, if they are retaining the contents of the calls, is using the metadata to find who they're interested in. Once they find someone who looks interesting, then they dig in and have someone manually review the calls. But they don't have the resources to listen to everyone's calls, but they do have the resources to scan everyone's call records. There was was there a woman in the front, the second row? All right, we'll go with the one four back and then we'll make our way forward.
Just following up on a previous question, apparently the NSA was able to get around, you know, requesting data from the companies and paying the bills, as we saw. So are other companies, are other government agencies potentially able to get around that also?
There's no way to get around paying the companies.
So the NSA did pay for all that data?
The NSA pays its bills. We can have a debate about whether the companies have screwed over their customers and not and provided data when they shouldn't have, but let's rest assured that the companies are not going to let anything go out for free. We learned this week that part of the NSA surveillance program involves payments of around $100 million a year to internet companies. So in some way, the internet companies are double dipping. They get, you know, $50 a month for your internet bill, and they get some money from the government too. The woman there.
So, you were talking a lot about GPS and location tracking today, and I've seen these advertised. I never got one because they looked very impractical to me, because if they worked, then I couldn't receive phone calls and actually use my phone. But you see them sell, like, cell phone sleeves to prevent signals from your phone or somebody, like, from turning on your phone and listening to your conversation. Are those actually...
Those work.
Do they work?
So the devices you're talking about, the technical name for those is a Faraday cage. So they work. I wouldn't leave your phone on unless it was in airplane mode before you put it in, because your phone will constantly be looking for the tower. It'll be like you left your phone on the airplane and then you land 2 hours later and your battery's dead. So they work, but the downside is that you can't make any calls. If you don't want to use one of those, I'm told that some brands of cocktail shakers work relatively well too. And then you have the bonus of being able to make yourself a martini afterwards. there are Faraday sleeves. I mean, look, if the police seize your phone and they're worried about you remotely wiping your phone, they'll put them in one of these bags. So they do exist for, I mean, they're tested. You can, you know, test it yourself. You can put your phone in the bag and then call yourself and see what happens. The gentleman with the glove.
In your closing there, when you were talking about the NSA having all these records of every phone call we make, I guess one of my questions is, the phone company also has all that information, and there's no law to stop them from selling that to anyone. So why are we more concerned about the government doing it? Obviously, the government can come and arrest people, and you know that there's that. But then, the telephone companies can do whatever they want with that data.
So actually, there is a law that prevents them from selling it. They're not actually, they're allowed to sell aggregate data. So they can say, you know, this month there were 200,000 people who visited the stadium, and we know that because of our cell phone location records. But they're not allowed to tell the stadium, these are the people who were at your stadium. They're not allowed to sell records of who you call. Now, if you go through a very messy divorce and you hire a private investigator, and they want to find out whether your spouse is cheating on you, what they will likely do is call up the phone company and pretend to be you and obtain your call records that way. And that's illegal. But that is a routine practice for phone company records to be obtained. I'll also note that, you know, you may think, okay, well, look, Google's scanning my email for ads. You know, why am I worried about the FBI having it or the NSA having it? I think the answer, of course, here is that Google can't arrest you. Google can't deny you your freedom. They can't drop a bomb on your house with a drone. I think that the government has a different set of powers. And, you know, you may be comfortable. You are engaging in like a willful commercial act, a transaction with Google. You didn't invite the FBI to come along for the ride. And so I think we have a reasonable interest in keeping our information out of the government's hands. The government has a desire to get that data, and I think we should be doing everything we can to make sure they follow the rules and to make sure that the rules are robust and do everything to protect our privacy. I think that's all the time I have. Thank you all for your questions. Thank you for showing up.